Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Giant Time is here. That's right, we are still talking Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan / Vancouver on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal Patrick Hamilton coming to you once again from the glorious alleyways of New York City, the biggest of the apples. This is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. So we will be unpacking all the gory details of Friday the 13th Part 8 in the hopes that a Lakeview High graduate's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes that we can make at their expense. And as always, there is only one person I trust to train me to become the ultimate undead serial killer fighter, the one and only Gina Radcliffe. How are you doing, Gina?
I'm good. Did you receive the package I sent you with the matching tracksuit?
Yes, okay. I'm all set. I plan on running along the beach here in Southern California, hopefully with somebody on my side so we can cheer and we can wear very tiny shorts and then hop into the surf and celebrate together an accomplishment that only they know about.
I'm just gonna be the one that like rides their bicycle, like punch out, just yelling at you while you're jogging down the street.
So you're gonna go for the sort of Charles McCullough school of teaching somebody how to do something? Just yell at me, fight harder, punch more.
Exactly.
That's how you teach people things, at least if you listen to this movie. And I hate to tell you this, Gina, but we are not alone. That's right. We have a special guest. She is a producer and host on Now This Nerd, the finest video hub of all things genre and geek, the one and only Kaya Quinn. How are you doing, Kaya?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent. Well, the world's falling apart. Yeah. And I feel like I'm hitting a reconstituted raisin with bones and with a giant mask on, and it's just exhausting the hell out of me. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, I'm just, I don't know, I think it's always good for me to just rewatch a bunch of horror movies to distract myself from everything in life, and this happens to be one of my favorite ones to watch because some of the deaths are absolutely ridiculous.
That is very true. It is kind of crazy in parts. It's kind of boring in others. It's super weird. Jason breathes very heavily throughout it and is very squishy. There's a lot of fun things and a lot of weird things about it, but a little while ago, approaching Halloween, you guys at Now This had a series of How to Kill, and you went through a lot of different horror movie villain icons, and the very first one that came up for me was Jason Voorhees, and I'm like, oh, you obviously have a love for this franchise. I just put it out into the universe, that universe being Twitter. I said, I have to have this person on the podcast to talk about this crazy movie. So Kaya, what was your first introduction to the Friday the 13th franchise?
Well, my first introduction to Jason in general and basically every horror movie was my mom. When I was a kid, I actually couldn't watch any horror movies because I was terrified, and I used to sleep in the same bed as my mom because I was always terrified of everything. And I'm like 8 years old, and as soon as she thought I was asleep, she'd watch a bunch of horror movies. And so it was mostly just me under the covers, feigning to be asleep, half watching like this guy in a hockey mask run around killing people. And it was terrifying for me, but now I love it. So
I was a very scared child. The legendary, if it were, story about me is that I was scared of the Pink Panther theme, which is very jazzy, but it's also meant to evoke a man sneaking into your fucking house.
Oh, yeah. Home invasion.
So everything scared me, and I wasn't allowed to watch horror movies, so I came at everything through Fangoria. That's how I intellectually approached horror movies. But I'm right there. Like the world scared the living hell out of me.
No, I remember I still can't listen to the Jeepers Creepers song because it freaks me out, even though it's just a jaunty little tune.
Makes sense. And then there's everything attached to Jeepers Creepers. let's not go down that road. So, do you have a favorite of the Friday the 13th series?
I'm a sucker for the original just because I like being the person in the room who's just like, actually, Jason wasn't the murderer in the first movie. It was his mom. And it's just like such a funny twist to me that it's just a mom running around. And then I watched it for the first time properly as an appreciation in probably my first year of college. And I'm waiting for it to be Jason and it's not. And then you have like the last image of him like jumping out the water. It was just ridiculous and hilarious for me.
I know, I totally get it. We really have a lot of respect for the original, as odd as it is in parts, but we love the oddities of it. I mean, that's why we're doing the podcast, because while we absolutely love this series, there's some weirdness going on, that's for certain. And Mrs. Voorhees is incredible. She wears a great sweater and she has amazing forearm strength.
Yeah.
She's got that farm wife strength going on.
Damn Skippy. Well, you know, when you're stirring up that shit on a shingle or that oatmeal for everyone in the camp, I guess you just build it up over time. So let's get right into it.
What is left of it?
Yeah. Who is still left alive at this point in the movie? Let's do a quick body count. Of our main cast, we have Rennie, and she's, you know, a girl who gets to experience the rest of this movie high off her ass on heroin, and I've never been more jealous of anyone in my entire life. Then we have Sean, her boyfriend, who it took me up until this point to notice is wearing green pants.
I don't think I've caught that, but I will now. Oh, I will not notice anything else with the color of his pants for the remaining 25 minutes or so of this movie.
Well, almost all Friday the 13th costuming choices are odd. Of course, we have Charles, a man who made fake news a way of life before it destroyed all of ours, and with the exception of the unfortunate victims, that's all that we have in terms of our main cast still left alive.
Julius.
Well, we're talking about Julius.
Well, okay.
So Julius is on deck to die. So we're going to discuss Julius in detail, primarily because he is the best character in the movie. Julius is, he's an anomaly in a great many ways, but one of the best is he doesn't catch Friday the 13th disease. When he's in trouble, runs. When he sees a phone, he calls the police. When he sees a weapon, he picks it up and does not drop it.
So are you basically saying that Julius behaves like a logical human being would behave when faced with danger?
Yes.
Instead of just you know leaning up against a wall and sobbing and slowly slumping to the ground.
Yeah. Like the couple on the boat early in this movie or any other victim of the Friday the 13th series, when confronted with an undead serial killer, that he doesn't just melt into the background and wish upon a star that it would all be over, or just lie on his back like a turtle who's been turned over on its shell. He's the ultimate rarity. He's a man of action. He should be the leader. Everyone should be listening to Julius.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say that Julius deserves to make it to the end of the movie, and yet Julius also, you know, he rightfully gets the best, most memorable death in the whole movie. Quite possibly, I would say up there with the whole series. I mean, certainly this is the only thing that anybody really remembers, I think, of part eight, other than the fact that very little of it is actually spent in Manhattan, is, oh right, that's the one where the guy gets his head clean punched off his body.
Yeah, I think Julius's death is probably in my top five. It's that one, and it's Mark in the wheelchair, who are my two that I always remember.
Yes, that's my favorite too. Yeah.
See, I knew you two would get along.
But, like, I don't know. Sometimes Julius doesn't seem the smartest to me, because his plan in the beginning was just to take a bunch of weapons and go on the offensive and then also split up. And I'm like, for me, I would want all the weapons on the ship in one area that's being protected and is safe, not to individually as teenagers go after a mass murderer.
Yeah, but they also don't necessarily know who is doing it, because I don't know that Julius automatically buys that it's the undead corpse of Jason Voorhees running around killing people. The Occam's razor of this is that it's the crazy Ralph Maritime Edition guy who's most likely. And I think any one of those teenagers could take on that guy and that guy's mop. With the exception of Charles, who gets stabbed in the arm.
And looks mildly put out over it. Yeah. Just, again?
He suffers no consequences for that stabbing. It's never brought up again. He's never felled by it. It does not come back into play. It's just something that occurs.
It's just but a scratch.
That's very true. So, yeah, up until this point, you know, that we rejoin the action, Friday the 13th Part 8 has basically been Die Hard on a boat. And then our survivors make landfall at a wharf, or as Charles calls it, the worst place ever to dock a boat. You know, at the place where people dock boats.
Well, he thought you should have been able to steer the boat right into the middle of Times Square.
It only makes sense. If you could just pull up to the Pussycat Theater or whatever the fuck else was in Times Square at the time.
Yeah, I don't think they had a Planet Hollywood there yet.
I mean, wasn't there always a Planet Hollywood there deep down?
Is that kind of a you've always been the caretaker kind of thing? There's always been a Planet Hollywood here.
Yes, we've always lived in the castle. There's always been a Planet Hollywood in 42nd Street. It just had naked ladies in it. Instead of a statue of Sylvester Stallone frozen in a block of ice with his nuts out. Whenever I can slice Stallone's nutsack into anything, boy howdy. I can't resist. Yeah, we kind of return to action for our section of the movie. Just having seen Jason, in quotes, rescue Rennie? In the sense that she happened to be around when he could kill two other people. And
yeah, what happened? Like, what are we... He smashes a guy's face into the pipe, and then it cuts away to Julius. But what happened? Did he just walk away and let her escape? Because when next we see Rennie, she's just kind of staggering around and you know, and looking at things with that drug cam effect where everything's really wavy and all. And, I mean, Patrick... I'm kind of a square. Have you used controlled substances? Not heroin. I don't assume you've ever used heroin, but you know, have you used any controlled substances? And if so, do you actually get that kind of wavy line effect when you're looking at things?
I think this movie proves that for this particular Canadian director, he's never touched any altered substance, or he has no concept of how to translate it to the filmic realm, because. Let's put this up against any sort of depiction of heroin. Let's choose one out of the atmosphere. Oh, Train Spotting. This doesn't feel anything even akin to that. They don't even put the effort into it. It's the most, it's like if someone on the set of Quincy said, we need to do one section where the victim feels kind of hazy because they took drug. They don't even like say what drug it is.
They had a marijuana cigarette.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I was definitely going to say that it very much reminded me of some sort of like after school special effect where she goes to a party and somebody slips something in her drink. And I actually made real life air quotes with that. We don't know what it is. She's hopped up on the goofballs or something, and she kind of staggers home after the party, and everything's just sort of wavy and at a Dutch angle, and people talk to her, and their voice echoes.
Yeah.
And she just kind of looks at them like she just woke up, and that is definitely the effect they have achieved here. And it seems to wear off surprisingly quickly.
It doesn't last, which is unfortunate because I think most of the movie would benefit from more drug haze. if this became more of a Cheech and Chong like exploration of the night,
I wanted to look at Jason and Jason's head like turns into like a chicken, or like you mentioned like a Cheech and Chong movie, like just a giant smoking joint or something like that, and she just looks really puzzled and you know make it into something funny. I mean, they are trying to go for some weird comedy bits in this last 20 minutes or so, and so why not just take it one step further?
I would love the movie a lot more if it just had like Jason with a chicken head in the middle of it. That sounds like a great sequence for me.
I mean, it's not the worst idea, and this movie is full of the worst ideas possible. I mean, this movie makes that Angel Dust After School special with Helen Hunt look like crank. I mean, it is so fucking square. It's unbelievable. So this film is terrible at delivering drug imagery. I don't know that anyone was necessarily tuning in to find it here, but it's just not its strong suit. Let's talk about Julius in particular. I like Julius as a character. He's a man of action.
He wears a sporty tracksuit throughout the entire movie, which is great.
He looks like a bit like a Patriot from Marvel Comics.
Yeah, he does. I just like that they really wanted to emphasize that this is a jock, so he's just always in a tracksuit unless he's like in a boxing match.
Yeah, he's always throwing air punches, just that kind of guy who's always on. I'm surprised they didn't show him boarding the ship with like a case of Muscle Milk under his arm.
He's an undefeated high school boxer. Now, I grew up here in LA, and I can't say that we had any high school boxing matches. Certainly not sanctioned.
Yeah, I was going to say in the hallways maybe, but not actually like arranged for, you know, like where you earn like a title for it. That seems a little dangerous.
A lot of unwarranted headshots. It just doesn't seem like something that happens in reality. And I think the only reason it does is they want to make him a formidable, ideally, opponent for Jason.
But it's also just like a teenager who likes to box against like this 40-year-old undead monster man. It didn't really seem fair from the get-go, but I found it really funny just the contrast between the two, and like they actually gave him he was gonna have a shot at this. And like, this is not okay.
Well, as soon as like his first shot and then every shot thereafter kept catching him in the mask, I was like, oh, this isn't going to work out for him. he does have some of his jaw exposed, and I couldn't quite figure out. I mean, I'm not a strong woman. I've thrown a punch once in my life, and it did not go too well. But I do know you definitely don't connect to anything like a mask. Like, you try to hit something that isn't covered in hard plastic.
Yeah, he would have done much better punching Jason in the throat than in a mask. I mean, I counted here. I did due diligence. Julius connects with Jason's head 27 times. He also connects with him with about 20 plus body blows. Although, when he starts to get tired, he starts to hit his chest. There's a story being told in this sequence. Unlike, you know, the sequence in the disco where the story is, why is there so much popcorn? Why is there booze on this high school trip to New York? What is this fucking guitar song, and who would listen to it or dance to it? But the foley that's going on in this particular fight is really weird. The sound the body blows make are really gross. It sounds like he's punching a body bag full of Jell-O pudding.
Again, very squishy. I keep coming back to the word squishy to describe many of the effects in this. And yeah, that's a perfect description. It's just something very wet and very mushy that he is repeatedly punching.
This is the moistest of all the Friday the 13th.
I hate that word.
There's nothing to like about it. It's accurate, though.
Yeah, he is punching like a very squishy, wet Jason, so I guess that's one time where the squishy sounds make sense to me.
I mean, I just felt like his fist should have just like just gone through him at one point, just like a bag of wet leaves.
That's what is Jason comprised of? I mean, just
mildew and worms. I think at this point,
it's lake silt, but with the ability to move. Like, how are his muscles working? Why does he need to breathe?
I think I did compare him to Oogie Boogie before. He's basically Oogie Boogie, just a sack barely held together of insects and rot.
Oh my god! Probably some fish in there.
Oh, exactly. Definitely some fish.
It would have been funny if he like punched him and like a tiny fish had came out or something.
It just flops out on the ground. And Jason's feet just kind of just you squirms a little bit and then dies.
Just every time he punches him, goldfish fly out of him like he's a carnival game.
Or just like, you know, a license plate at some point. Just you know, an old you know, tire, a boot.
An old boot from the bottom of the lake.
He's basically that shark that isn't Jaws that they catch in Jaws.
They don't want to find that little Kintner boy rolling out onto the dock.
I mean, throughout this movie earlier, there's so much slime that they've put him in that the performer playing Jason slips and slides at various points in the movie. He just, all of it is dripping down to his shoes and he can't get his footing. It's just...
It's like, Jesus Christ, what's happening to my body?
I mean, Jason is going through changes.
He doesn't understand them.
Every person goes through.
He's a little frightened, but understands that this is a thing he has to learn to deal with.
I mean, there was definitely a certain consistency to him in part six. We knew that he rose from the grave, but there was still a lot of zombie flesh going on. In part seven, it got a little wiggy because he had been in under the water, but he came up and at a certain point kind of dried off. He was mostly like bones held together by a rotted workman's suit. And then this is just this pile of slime that your kid makes in second grade with laundry detergent and inconsistent eyeballs. Before we even get to Julius's fight, though, we do get to revisit an ideal location from the opening of this movie, and that is the phone booth that says "Gangs Rule" on it.
Of course, it doesn't work.
No, gangs do not rule. No. We don't get to see a lot of gang rule on display in this movie, both before this or after it. Certainly, those junkies are not a great example.
The gangs are very small. They only seem to consist of maybe two or three people at a time, which isn't really a gang so much as a small group.
Yeah, yes. It's like me in high school. Me and two people who were like, all right, we'll hang out with you and have lunch. That's the enthusiasm of these gangs. I mean, yeah. The Warriors could tear through these motherfuckers in like 5 seconds. These are not cool gangs.
I mean, I'm pretty sure the gangs from West Side Story probably end up being cooler and tougher than these gangs.
Those gangs have a code, and they have jazz hands, and they are very agile. And we get to see one of our favorite things that Jason does, which is break a window. Jason hates to be able to see through things, possibly because his mask restricts his vision. But the way Kane Hodder breaks this window in particular is he punches the bottom left-hand corner. And it seems to require more effort than he gives because there's a little bit of like, oh, ow. At the end of it, he reacts like, that didn't go well. Ow. Like he hit his funny bone or something.
Ouch.
Like he seems tired at this point. Like
he seems tired throughout the whole movie.
I mean, but he's teleporting. He barely has to move. And yet he lumbers everywhere and he's always breathing hard. And he did just walk along the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. I'll give him that.
Somehow.
We don't chalk it up to every other possible solution to this movie. Why does every time we see ghost child Jason, he's a different kid who looks a different way, including at one point in a bathroom looking like the kid from the fucking Grudge out of nowhere? Someone should have decided, does Jason have hair or does Jason not have hair? And what does the hair look like? And they're like, we'll decide on the day. So, yeah, Jason hates windows. Do you think Jason's fetish for breaking through windows is stronger than his newfound fetish for killing people on a boat? Or does that old one win out?
Oh, the old one wins out. It's much more convenient. I mean, you know, how many opportunities? I mean, we see windows every day. How often do you have the opportunity to just get on a boat and just kill someone?
Yeah, I think that Jason has a tried and true method. He likes, like, a window is a nice distraction and how to spice things up. But really, when it comes down to it, when he wants to get things done, it's always nice to kill people on a boat.
Yeah. He's really being pushed and pulled because there's not as many windows on a boat. But, you know, smashing through a door or window, you know, doesn't feel the same as killing someone on a boat. Man, no wonder he's tired. I'm tired just thinking about it. So Julius does the smart thing, right? He flees. Now, he does pull that one, you know, bit of Scream critique that does play out. Instead of running away towards an escape, he runs up towards a place that has no escape.
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously the answer is because the plot required him to do this, but nobody in these movies, and I know this is a stunning observation that no one has ever made before, nobody in these movies does anything that an actual human being would do.
No, they only do the things that a script requires them to do, and they're only as smart or stupid as the script, hence me having to school fools on Twitter this week about part two and how Jenny is like the smartest person in any of the Friday the 13th, because the film demonstrates that she's smart, so that the point in the movie which she does something that's like an educated guess, it's a good bet, because they've set you up for like, oh, she's smarter than everyone else. She's certainly smarter than her dumb fuck boyfriend, who's basically a sex idiot who doesn't wear underwear. I get it, but come on, he's a sex idiot. And then, you know, when she makes a play like, yeah, I'm going to put on this corpse juice laden sweater and pretend to be mom. Like, that's a huge, huge bet. But she's set up so that you're like, maybe she has an insight here. And then it plays out that way. Julius is just, we've been told he's a boxer and he's actually going to put up a fight. So in a way, that's why he comes off better, because once he gets up on this rooftop with the majestic downtown look at Vancouver in the background, decidedly non-New York view of New York, he at least gets in, you know, 20 plus body blows that do almost nothing to stop Jason. Although he does kind of stagger a little bit. There's a bit of rope-a-dope happening here. In cinematic terms, Jason is pulling a Rocky Balboa, like he's leading with his face in the hopes of wearing somebody down.
Yeah, I don't think that registers on Jason. He's a sort of, I do kind of like how Jason's reaction is. It's you know, sort of like, yeah, all right, yeah, okay, sure, this is funny, and you know, and then like finally he's just like, you done yet? it's like watching someone, you know, watch a child who's having a tantrum. You know, you just let them do their little flailing at you, and you know, you wait to let them rest for a second, and it's like, you get that all out of your system, you know?
I just like how he just like stands there throughout the entire thing, and he's like, this is cute, you're trying, that's nice, this is different. Let's see how this goes, and he's just like, cool. And then I love how polite Julius is, and he's like, okay, you can have a hit now.
Which, why would you let him do that, Julius?
I guess, like, why would you do that?
You do not have to be sportsmanlike here.
He really doesn't. There's no point to this, like, all right, I'm not even going to put up a defense.
Yeah.
Why? You can't be that tired that you're like, all right, if you're going to kill me. It's a violation of the character. Like, you've made me root for him up until this point. That seems like a stupid move. He's rewarded for it by having his head punched clean off. And when I say clean, I mean there is a clear delineation of where his head tears away from the rest of his neck. And we see that in very vivid red as it tumbles off the top of this building and into a trash bin.
Yeah, and you could just turn the movie off at this point, because this really is the high point of it.
Oh, I beg to differ, because I feel we are going to cover a section of this that is even more ludicrous than this. This is definitely the best kill. Far and away, it's the best kill. But I think in terms of sheer insanity, we're about to meet its
match. Oh, yes, 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 yes. When Jason's ability to predict the future is put to a remarkable test.
I mean, he does possess some, previous to this, psychic adjacent powers, because he knows people's fuck style and uses it against them.
No, I think he literally looked into the future somehow. He tore a rip in the time-space continuum and saw what was going to happen and when this police car was going to show up and exactly how much time it would be required to find the exact dumpster that Julius's head landed in, remove it from the dumpster, and put it on the gear shift? in the car? Yeah,
what is it placed on? Like, I assume...
It's too high for the gear shift, though.
I thought it might be on top of the shotgun, because that's generally where cops put shotguns.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
I only know this from cop shows. I haven't seen the back of a police car since high school, so I couldn't tell you.
I haven't seen the back of a police car since last Tuesday. Things may have changed since then.
But before we get to that police car, we see Rennie wandering around in her drug haze, touching her face.
White Rabbit playing in the background.
Yeah, it's, she has not, like the movie, has not touched a drug, nevertheless the several drugs that it would require for her to have this reaction. And then Sean appears, and Sean has a interesting reaction. First of all, Sean looks like the little brother in snow clothes in A Christmas Story. There's so much volume in what he's wearing, he can't even put his arms down. And secondly, his first line upon finding Rennie is, "What did they do to you? Motherfucker, how about, are you okay?" Like, what did they, like, let's get into details later. Are you okay?
Are like, you good? Are you on drugs? Is everything okay? Blink once if you need help.
Exactly. Are you bleeding? Is all of the parts still attached to you? Are you okay? It is a slight improvement in empathy from Rick from part 3, who spends the most of his time with an assault victim making hourly requirements for fucking. So there's...
Are you over that yet?
I think we should fuck in the morning and then also have a dedicated fucking time at night. What do you mean you were assaulted? Oh my God, Rick. Jesus Christ. Do you remember solution, Rick?
Rick, the solution to your problem is in my pants.
You got everything you need right here.
He here, could fuck away any problem. He really could.
Let me comfort you.
With my penis. That was Rick's solution to everything. Like, why did you call me if you didn't want my penis involved? Sometimes you just want a friend, asshole.
It's like you can't invite him anywhere without his penis being invited.
that is the third wheel on all of their tables and everything.
I mean, I'd invite Rick to the party, but you know he's just going to bring his penis. Oh, man. So, yeah, Sean's a slight step up from that. But there's also this very... He's not attached emotionally to anything that's happening here. Because when he finds Rennie, his reaction equates to when I finally found Star Anise in the spice aisle. Like, oh, there it is.
Yeah, it's remarkable that this actor, and I have not looked up if he's done anything else, his acting actually gets worse as the movie goes on. And he seems to forget his, and I'm not saying his character does any sort of weird, like hard left turn in his motivations. I feel like either the actor decided to try to do something with the role in which maybe he's trying to project that he is, you know, kind of losing it out of, you know, fear and not knowing what's going on. But he just seems confused most of the time. And he just seems like he's not really sure how he should react to his girlfriend. Are they dating?
I mean, you don't generally give cheap necklaces to girls who you're not going out with.
The girl that he feels feelings for. You generally don't act like when you find her after you're certain she's been dragged away to her doom and horrendously assaulted and possibly killed with, you know, mild surprise and annoyed, what did they do to you? You know, I mean, he just feels like he's trying on different, you know, ways to play this character and never actually made a decision on it before filming began.
Yeah, I didn't really notice him in the beginning of the movie because he was just like, there was a lot of characters introduced and he didn't really stick with me. I'm like, okay, Captain's son, sure. And then all of a sudden he just started getting very aggressive and talking back. And then the acting started getting progressively worse. And I'm like, I like Sean now. He's just trying so hard to make himself stand out and it's going horribly.
And now that he's in the city, he's just like wow. Everybody in, you know, from the minute they arrive in the city, they all act like they've like crash landed on Mars. they're. I mean, I realize they're scared of Jason, but just wandering around, they're wandering around wide eyed and you know, frightened and confused, like they have no idea where they are. You're in a city. You're in a city in the United States, about 50 miles away from where you normally live. And they're just like, strangers in a strange land. And it's just such a weird, you know, off-putting way of handling that.
I know that we have weird Junes here in Los Angeles. We have like this thing where summer doesn't really start until the end of July. But is it common for June in New York City to be layering to this degree weather?
No.
Where?
No.
I mean, Sean is basically putting on the full Steve Bannon here. He's got one blue t-shirt, then a green t-shirt, then a sweater, then his members only jacket on underneath.
No, you should be, they should all be panting like Jason and just sweat should be pouring off of them.
They should all be as wet as Jason is.
Yes.
With their own sweat.
Everybody should be squishing when they walk.
I mean, certainly in my time on the East Coast, it did rain quite a bit in the summer, but this people are not suffering from rain exposure here. They're freezing to death. We see everyone's breath, including a walking corpse. That's how cold it is.
Well, this has been a repeated thing in these movies where it ostensibly takes place in the summertime, but everybody's talking about how cold they are and everybody's wearing multiple layers and a lot of scenes you can see their breath, and it would be interesting to see how, you know, when these movies were filmed and why they were filmed then.
I assume because they're coming out at a summer release. That's when most of them were. They were usually, oh fuck, it's August, we need a movie. That was when they were slated, that they're generally filmed in, you know, December, January, February of that year, because you didn't have a bunch of composite shots to put together for this stuff. It was basically everything was in camera for the most part. So they had a quick turnaround. But yeah, I mean, for example, Colleen is like a human being trapped inside a mobile sweater cocoon. She has that one character from Dilbert's hair and then a giant sweater, and she's freezing the entire time. And then she runs into Sean and Rennie and Rennie's fucking dipshit of an Uncle Charles. And the first thing they say is, Rennie says that Jason's here, and Charles is like, fuck, don't bring that asshole into this. Don't embarrass me in front of this clearly Canadian cop. That is the most Canadian cop I've ever seen captured on film.
Yeah, he should have just walked in the screen with like a Tim Hortons cup in his hand or something.
I mean, outside of wearing all denim and just having a beer outside of shot, he's very Canadian. It's like, oh, it's a tall tale indeed you got there, but I'm bound to believe ya. I might have gone into our town. My apologies to the Canadians. I'm not good with accents. It's just not my bag. But he is sincerely Canadian. He's about as Canadian as it gets.
I just love it when they always film in Canada, and like obviously people film in Canada all the time and try to disguise it as other places, and then you spend most of the movie trying to spot the Canadian things that just make it not where it is. From the Canadian actors to the Vancouver skyline, and it's just ridiculous.
of all the people to give, you know, you need somebody who's going to convey either the prototypical Irish accent, because, you know, this movie exists in the 1940s, or someone who can do a legitimate or at least passable New York accent. This guy isn't even trying. It's terrible. The only thing he really tries at is not shooting Colleen dead, which he almost does.
Also, I'm a little puzzled at the fact that one cop shows up. I mean, most, even back then when there was budget shortages in the pre-Giuliani New York City, you generally traveled, you know, in pairs.
Cops are fucking gnats. Anyone there's one, there's like a dozen. All standing around. Fuck this. I'm not even going to pretend. Fuck the police.
Oh, shit. Hashtag political. Kill by kill, taking a hard left turn.
I was going to say both sides there. Fuck that noise. I live in L.A. Fuck that shit.
Yeah, it's that liberal horror movie fan content you come to love.
That's right. Every day I lose two people on Twitter. It's great. I suck at Twitter. So then, of course, once they get into the car, we get to see one of our most delightful sort of tropes in the Friday the 13th series, Jason Voorhees, interior/exterior decorator. He leaves a corpse where everyone can find it. He's fished Julius's head out of that dumpster and propped it up somewhere, somehow, for everyone to find.
Let's review again how he would have had to do this. Just the Swiss watch timing required from this corpse of a mentally impaired child who has been murdered several times, who has, you know, after growing up and apparently just surviving off of, you know, raccoons and old boots in the woods, he would have to have known A, where Julius's head landed, mm-hmm. B, that they would call the police, that they would, what alley they would come down, what time the police would arrive, that the police would come by himself, that the policeman would stand in the exact place where Jason could reach out and drag him away, and how long it would take for him to be able to put Julius's head in the police car, which would evidently be left open and accessible for anybody to drive away with, even though this is, you know, apparently some sort of post-apocalyptic hellscape New York City, the same New York City that Chud takes place in. This just takes such an incredible amount of foresight and timing on his part that it is, all you can do is laugh. I mean, for one thing, I mean, just, you know, surprise, there's a severed head here. That's always a funny thing to me, no matter what. That is always a shot that is hilarious to me. And it's been done a couple times in the past few movies. You've got the head in the potted plant in part 7. That's right. Always hilarious. You've got the Sculpey head in part 6. That's hilarious. Or was that part 7 too? I think that was part 7 too. There were two severed heads in that. That's always a funny shot to me. But the way that this is done and what it would have required is just like, that is probably one of the biggest, oh, come on, moments in this entire series.
I love that all four of them are in the backseat and they react like, ah, oh, god damn it.
It's like, really?
Ah, we'd finally done it.
Jinkies, kids, there's a head. I'm just like...
And the cop reacts by grabbing the radio and asking for backup a day late, a dollar fucking short. Jason snatches him like Dracula or the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, he does just kind of swoop on in there. Like, late. I would have loved, they might as well just gone one step further and just had the cop like just screaming like, ah! He's being dragged
away. And the cop pulls the cord out of the radio, which...
Conveniently.
conveniently, but... In the end, it doesn't matter. I'll tell you why in a few seconds. Let's go through the progression of what happens next. Everyone else starts pawing at the door that they're next to, but it's the back of a police car. It's locked. Rennie climbs into the front seat because there's no spit partition there. And she gets into that seat, and immediately Jason has gone from the shadows where he mysteriously killed the policeman to right in front of them. We get another BAMF. She puts it into drive, and she makes Jason pull a full-on TJ Hooker over the hood of that police car. She rounds a corner doing 45 and a 10, and then we get to see version 7B of Jason shivering in his trunks and or underwear.
Shivering and flailing and just, what is it? What are they doing with this character?
I don't know. The makeup has evolved again. This time he looks like Frank Langella's Skeletor from Masters of the
Universe. Yeah, his face is like melting or some shit. I don't know what's going on, but...
Jason's having a really tough day.
He's
not looking his best. It's getting worse as the day goes along, and he's just getting more increasingly upset about it.
Rennie tries to run over the hallucination, because why not? Don't drive on Skag, kids. And slams the police car into a retaining wall. And sadly, this does not kill Ghost Jason. It also doesn't bring Frank Langella into this movie, which the move this movie desperately needs to make.
Yeah, no, that's like two Frank Langella, salutes. There's the, Skeletor, and then there's Jason playing Dracula for a minute.
Exactly. It's like an open love letter to Frank Langella. And I'm here for it, goddammit. Sean manages to pull Rennie out of the wreckage. Charles just ambles out on his own. This is significant because we see that Sean is again doing all the rescuing, whereas Charles just doesn't even take a single second to consider that Colleen is still in that car before it blows the fuck up.
Because of course it does. Why not?
I think this is payback for leaving those four students in the restaurant that Sean declared destroyed earlier in the movie.
Well, that's fine. That's fine though, because everybody reacts to seeing her, kill before their very eyes with about the same amount of emotion and passion as she reacts to the news that the restaurant has been destroyed. Just to kind of, I guess that's sad.
Unfortunate.
And people then immediately forgotten and not mentioned by anyone ever again.
I'm also just like, why didn't she just get out the car? I don't understand why she stayed in there. I would have been clamoring over Charles to get out.
I just picture her sitting there with her hand out, waiting for Charles to drag her away. Just, well, fuck you too. And then, explosion.
I mean, I just would've... slightly stunned from the impact of the car, and all she would need is a little bit of help to exit the car, but it's Charles, so she's fucking dead.
I really would have loved a lost clip of her holding her hand out waiting for him to drag her away, and he just looks at her just kind of and just her hand turns she just gives the finger and then boom.
That'd be good for the director's cut of the movie.
Yes.
Just the final flip off.
So fuck you, Charles, you're the worst. I'll see you in hell.
Fuck you, Charles. Boom. Explosion. The other beautiful part of that car crash is that when Rennie looks at Ghost Jason, it slows down into the stagger shot that's straight out of Lethal Weapon. when they have that fight in the middle of the front yard, and it goes bleep, 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 bleep. And it's supposed to convey how time is slowing down, but it just looks like a shitty editor's trick.
I just remember what scene you're talking about. That is like, bleep, bleep, click.
Jason also has weird teeth in that version of him. Why couldn't they just decide on a Ghost Jason?
Yeah, it's like they went when you watch stuff Star Wars movies, you see how they do different character designs until they finally settle on one. They just went on with all of them. There's somebody held up a notebook with some stick drawings of, here's some different versions of child deformed Ghost Jason, and they're like, I love them all. I just couldn't possibly pick one.
Bring them all to set. Or the other thing is that they kept hiring special effects makeup guys, and they would come to set and they would have a Jason and go, oh my God, that looks terrible. Well, after we film this, we're going to fire this guy and we're going to bring on somebody else. And then they bring on the next guy who has a completely different ghost Jason makeup. Like, well, that's worse than the last one. Well, let's bring in this other guy. My cousin knows how to do this. And they just keep hiring different people. But here, this explosion is where I think we reach the insanity nadir of this movie. This is the most... we've had three deaths here in the matter of just mere minutes. We've barely covered any time of this movie. So we have to discuss, while we are all together, the flame puddle flashback of Friday the 13th, Part 8,
which is, Jason takes which is hand. Probably the other than the ending, is the most nonsensical moment of this entire movie, because all I can say is, what happened here? I do not understand, because what would have to happen? There's no possible way that anybody can say, well, here's an explanation of how it could make sense. No, it does not make sense in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. Unless Rennie is a Time Lord. That's the only way that any of this could make sense.
I mean, she's dressed like one. Why not?
It's just secretly like a backdoor pilot for some kind of Doctor Who special. It's like no one told anyone.
If this came on BBC America on Christmas Day, I'd be like, yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's a different take, but sure, I'm on board. This all starts with a composite shot of a puddle that's on fire. Yet you're not hearing me wrong. It's literally a puddle of fire.
Puddle of fire.
A puddle of fire that composite shots into Crystal Lake. This is where we get to see the best outfit anyone has ever worn to teach a child to swim, a blue cable knit sweater.
He has no intention. I mean, generally speaking, I don't know if either of you ever tried to teach a child how to swim. I have. It's challenging. I will say that. But you do generally need to get in the water with them. That you know, especially if they are afraid of the water. That's usually results in the most successful way of teaching a small child how to swim.
Yeah, this is a terrible way of teaching a child to swim. The only other time I've ever heard of being tossed out of a rowboat to learn how to swim was my dad telling the story of how he learned to swim. He's Canadian. I'm beginning to think this is how all Canadians learn how to swim. Is this the second time I've slandered all Canadians on this particular edition? Maybe.
It seems very important to Charles that she learn how to swim, to the point that he is willing to psychologically traumatize her, and he does. He does. Yeah. And it's like, are you trying to? Do you want to raise an Olympic swimming champion? Why is this so important to you? I mean, swimming is not necessarily a life skill that is vital for a person to have. Should you know how to swim? It wouldn't hurt, but you know, you can get through life without having to know how to swim. But he's just like he's got just murder in his eyes. You know, if she doesn't get in that water, he's going to rear back and just kick her right square in the ass and send her into that water.
Also, it doesn't help to tell somebody a story of a kid that drowned right before you toss them into a lake with no instructions. He's not like, kick your legs, move your arms. This is how you breathe out of the side of your mouth. He's just like, swim, swim. That I taught my kid how to ride a bike. I didn't sit on the side of the sidewalk going, ride, pedal.
Just shove him down the steepest hill in your neighborhood.
You can balance, do it, motherfucker, or you're gonna die. You can do just it, like that other kid.
You can do it, kid. Steer.
I mean, I just appreciate what this means for Charles's character, that he's just always been inherently bad at things, and his idea 9 times out of 10, or 10 times out of 10 in this case, is just always the wrong one. And I don't understand. Like, if I'm terrified of water, I don't don't want to hear about someone dying. I mean, I learned how to ride a bike and I fell off my bike and then I saw a chicken leg on the floor and I thought my bone had fallen out of my leg. Which, long story short, I can't ride bikes. So I don't think this is the best method to go about it, but Charles is not the best method to go about for
how
anything.
How did he end up being in custody of this child? I mean, he couldn't possibly have been the most suitable parental figure in her life. He's her uncle, right?
I can only imagine that the deaths of her parents happened at a family reunion where everyone else was poisoned but her and Charles.
Just this, like, fireball just, like, you know, tears through the house and a family reunion is taking place and everybody's taken out except them. Because can you imagine, like, when you have a child, generally speaking, you hope to God this never happens, but you do have people in mind that if something should happen to you and the child's other parent, yeah, I think this person would be, you know, I would be all right with them, you know, raising my child to adulthood. I can't imagine anybody would have looked at Charles and, yeah, he's up to the task.
I just feel like it's probably the same person who said he was good enough to be, like, in charge of children for a career.
Yeah.
There are definitely some principals that you know, chose poorly in their profession, let's say. But I mean, to actually parent a child, I can't imagine anybody looking at him and saying, yeah, the incompetent sociopath should be left entirely alone, because there does not seem to be an aunt in this situation. It's just the two of them. Yeah,
no, he's a dedicated bachelor, that Charles.
Which you know, also puts a creepy, you know, tone on the whole thing that we won't get into. But you know, I can't imagine anybody with any sort of authority or knowledge of childcare would say, yeah, this guy's the one. He can, you know, he'll do a good job.
I mean, not since a screenwriter typed, Martha, why did you say that name? Why did you say Martha? Has a screenwriter thought, I've just sewn up this entire screen. I've explained it all. This is perfect. I'm going to have her thrown off the side of a boat for the second time, because I'm going to set it up and that she also gets thrown off the boat, the cruise ship, earlier in this whole thing, and sees Ghost Jason at the bottom of it. Now I'm going to explain everything. She can't swim, and the ghost of Jason pulls her down.
But he's not a ghost, though. I don't think that he is. I think he's just kind of existing down there, like Swamp Thing.
But here, this is a crazy thing. I mean, why are we looking for logic in this stupid movie? But let's try for a second here. The whole point of this dumbass franchise is that Jason didn't die. He crawled out of the bottom of the lake and was raised by raccoons next to the only working toilet within a 50-mile radius and somehow became a backwoods ninja that starts killing people. He then dies by machete from Corey Feldman. He's buried. We have a dream of two guys trying to dig him up and fuck his corpse in part 5, but that's a dream. Then in part 6, he's dug up by a different person playing the same character. He's struck by God lightning, and that's how he raises from the dead. He has not been sitting on the bottom of this lake, but that is the story that Charles says. And then she's like, no. Rennie's like, no, he's not. You're lying. He's not on the bottom of this lake. How does she know? Does she know? Who knows anything? I don't know the truth anymore!
Well, yeah, and it's definitely one of those things where something in the last couple of movies that has particularly nagged at me is everybody treating it like, well, we don't really know if this happened. It's just something parents tell their kids to, you know, make sure they behave. No, it really happened. And it's not like it's something that happened years ago. You know, all these movies only take place like a year or two apart from each other. I think that the longest gap of time between events is what took place in part 5 and what took place in part 4 to what took place in part 5. Yeah. But this is all within the same time period. And then everybody who presumably lives in the Crystal Lake area is also like, well, it's, you know, it's just a legend. We don't really know. I mean, that's just something our parents told us. Your parents told you. You were there when it happened. You know, like, you were alive. Still alive. When this, you were alive when this took place. And you know, and now, again, they're treating this like some sort of folk tale. You know, it's like, oh, you're making that up. He's not at the bottom of the lake. It's like, you know, well, you know, he was at one point, you know, but, you know, and the way the movie is, the way this scene is shot, no, he's really there. You know, he's just this, you know, rotting child that's at the bottom of this lake, you know, grabbing onto this little girl, because apparently nobody else has ever used this lake, which is patently false, as we've seen in the past, you know, 7 movies that took place, you know, that so far. People use this lake all the time. They can't stay away from this place, even after 80 people have been murdered. You know, they just, it's the only place you can go camping in southern New Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, Jason literally grabs her ankle. He holds her down, unless that's in her mind, but that would mean that's the unexplainable thing. Did she conjure this? Is this really happening?
And then what's more confusing is the ghost child Jason, who appears to her, seems to be imploring her to help him in some way, which also doesn't make sense. And again, you know, we'll get to the ending of the next episode. Is the way that plays out really doesn't make any sense. No. It puts some sort of, you know, you have to free him. And it's like, what? You have to free him? You know, and it's like, and then again, this is a, much like what happens in part 9, God love it. It seems to be suggesting a canon that's never been established before. That he's this like lost, anguished spirit trapped in this like relentless killing machine, and it just goes nowhere and makes no sense and is so fucking stupid.
It's all over explaining it, and we get another version of Ghost Jason here, who looks a little bit like Scrooge or Argus Finch in the Harry Potter series.
I just love all the looks that Jason can rock when he's a ghost. He can be a child, he can be a slightly deformed child, he can be Finch. It's just like whatever he feels to be in the mood of today, because I don't know how, why. I have a lot of questions. I'm more so confused as to how Jason and Rennie seems to be around the same age when she's getting dragged down, but in the present time, he's like a large 40-year-old or however old man, and she's like 17. I don't understand what's happening, but, you know, I've just come used to that in Friday the 13th at this point.
And it also doesn't make any sense, like, why he picks this particular time to... I mean, has she been haunted with these visions before, or is this like first time stepping on the boat? I mean, is she supposed to be, for lack of a better word, triggered in some way, and that she suddenly starts having these, you know, because surely this is not the first time that she's been near water since I mean, I don't know why being on a boat, particularly, you're not very likely to fall off of a cruise ship. I mean, I know it does happen from time to time, but usually it's because you're being helped along by someone. But I mean, if she grew up in the Crystal Lake area, this is not, being near water should be an everyday experience. So I'm not sure why you, and also an ocean is not a lake. So I don't know. I don't know if it's common for a person to be afraid of water, to be afraid of every sort of body of water, but it's all very convenient and you works out in a way that they don't even bother trying to make sense with, to a point that it actually becomes a little infuriating.
Yeah. And she tells nobody about this flashback that she has. She doesn't really communicate it to anybody. Oh, it's just so dumb. It's the dumbest fucking movie. And it's incompetent in a different way than Part 5, because Part 5 is both incompetent and sleazy and doesn't care. I think this movie cares intensely. It's just confused, like it has a head injury. And then it's trying to put together a puzzle that it can't, like, it's seeing double vision. It can't figure anything out. Oh, God.
It's just a wild ride that just ends up, I have more questions than I have answers, and I know that the flashback was supposed to answer and tie up some ends, and I'm more confused
than I was. It actually made it worse. So this really should be called Friday the 13th Part 8. Oh, come on.
I mean, it's not that they've run out of ideas. They've just run out of good ideas. They have plenty of shitty ideas. And
yeah, I guess I figured that the audience figured, you know, well, no one's going to buy that these people are going to come back to this campsite again. And indeed, I do think, other than the remake, this is the last time that anybody is actually at any point at the campsite. I have to rewatch part 8 or part 9, which I am desperately looking forward to. And I'm not even joking about that. I cannot wait. I think maybe it starts at Crystal Lake, but it doesn't really, ultimately does not end up there. And I guess they figure, well, we have to try some new bullshit. Let's do this, you know? and oh, it is bullshit.
So before we get any farther, it's quiz time, ladies and gentlemen. It's choose your own death venture. If you had to choose a way to die from one of the ones that are portrayed in this particular section of the movie, which one would it be and why? Up for bid today are have your head punched clean off and dumped into a dumpster, later propped up in a police car. Or you could disappear into a Vancouver alleyway and never return.
Let's say bitten and turn into a vampire.
Yeah. You become vampire, or you blow up in the back of a wrecked police car. And Kaya, as our esteemed guest, we turn to you first for your answer.
I would prefer to have my head punched off, because at least I can go out saying I punched Jason. And then, you know, it's nice to reuse and recycle. So it's nice to know that my head will later be used to decorate a car and live on that way.
You're recycling.
Yeah.
And you get to wear a great tracksuit.
Exactly.
And we don't know if that tracksuit tears away. That we could only suppose that it's like basketball pants. But I want to think that they are. I want to think that.
I like to think he was buried in his tracksuit.
That's the problem. Now, we used to be able to reference the Wikia for lots of weird invented backstories for each of the characters. Like, Gina would always find these Wikia entries where couples were always buried with one another. Like, they were just fucking. They're not buried with each other.
It's disappointing because, like, after, like, part 4, they kind of gave up on, like, whoever was, like, maintaining this. For, you know, kind of gave up on giving the characters, like, giving their parents names, even though their parents never showed up on camera, like, or were even referenced to, or, you know, mentioning, you know, like Patrick said, a lot of them, you know, were buried together, even though they'd, like, had been dating, like, a week or so. But yeah, this is just, you don't get that backstory for these characters anymore. But yeah, I mean, he was certainly buried in his tracksuit, probably with a pair of boxing gloves, too. Aww. Yes.
Yeah. R.I.P.D., Julius. We loved you. All right, Gina, what say you?
I don't even know why this is a contest. It's got to be Julius. I mean, Julius is the only death in this entire movie that really matters and is worth watching. I think I mentioned when we did the first episode about this, I first watched this movie drunk at a party with other drunk people. And just the gleeful cheering and laughter at this scene, I will never forget it. It is a warm, sentimental moment in my heart.
Three for three. There's no way you can say that you want to do anything other than have your head punched clean off and then get 2 points in a trash dumpster. Come on, man.
I think they should have just, I think it would have been great if they'd, like, if it had, like, there'd be like a buzzing sound somewhere with the trash can. And someone yelling, how about that?
From downtown. Vancouver, that is.
I just like that he died as a jock with his head making a 2-point score in the garbage bin.
On brand.
Julius.
All righty. Well, Kaya, where can people hear and see more from you on the glorious interwebs?
Well, if they want to see our How to Kill series that we're doing on my job's YouTube channel, Now This Nerd, you can check us out on YouTube for Now This Nerd, or also on Facebook at Now This Nerd, which plays on the now this entertainment channel on Facebook. But yeah, we have a lot of series. I also do another series where I talk about superhero costumes called Yellow Spandex. So most of my life is either how to kill things or what people are wearing. There's no in between.
I'm here for it. You should. I am subscribed. You should subscribe. Great stuff. Gina, where can people find you on the internet?
I write about 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com. I am in the middle of Christmas specials. By the time this goes live, I will have reviewed the Cabbage Patch Kids Christmas special, the Elf Christmas special, in which he visits a dying child, and the long-forgotten 1986 movie Babes in Toyland, starring a very young Drew Barrymore and a very young, slightly charismatic, but not quite there yet, Keanu Reeves. So watch out for that.
Keanu Reeves, slightly charismatic. You heard it here first. That will do it. Thanks, everybody. You want to reach out to us and tell us what you think of Friday the 13th Part 8? There's a couple easy ways to do it. Reach out on Twitter at KillByKillPod. You got something longer than 280 characters to say about it? Email us killbykillpod@gmail.com, at KillByKillPodcast on Instagram. And that will do it. Thank you ever so much, everyone who has rated and reviewed us on iTunes. If you would like to do so, we greatly encourage it. It helps us be seen and heard by more people. Make sure to put in your favorite kill from the Friday the 13th series or any of the films that we have covered, and we will read it here on the air. That's our solemn promise to you, the Kill by Kill listener. And so don't fret, my friends. The body count will continue next time. So for myself, and Gina and Kaya. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.